You are listening to a sermon by Rod Suderman, recorded on Sunday, October 4th, 2015, at the Point Grey Interminonite Fellowship in Vancouver, British Columbia. The opinions expressed by the speaker are not necessarily those of the church. This recording is licensed for personal use by individuals only, and may not be copied, broadcast, or redistributed without the prior permission of the church board. For more information, please visit our website at www.pgimf.org.
Well, the choices from the lectionary this Sunday were to talk about the theology of creation, or to talk about divorce and remarriage, or to look at a passage in Job. And I figured, well, let's look at God the Creator and human suffering, and then expanded a number of passages to add to what was already in the lectionary. And so we've had quite a number of readings from the book of Job. And I asked Andre to include those because I hope hearing some of those snippets would actually help us get a better understanding of the theology of the book. And the words of Job are written in the midst of chaos. Job has just lost his home, his farm, and all of his children are dead. And in chapter 2, he has lost his health, and his body is disfigured with open sores. "My days are without hope," he says. He wishes he were dead. "Let the day perish when in I was born." And Job asks God, "Why? Why is light given to one in misery?" I sat down last week and this week and read through all of those chapters of Job just to try to get a feel for it. And to be perfectly honest, it's not an easy book to read, and it certainly is not an easy book to preach on. But we're going to attempt anyway. But anytime anyone attempts to talk about God the Creator and human suffering, there's always a risk that we're going to come out sounding like Job's friends. Eliphaz, Bildad, Zophar, and Elihu. They come at first as friends to console and comfort Job as he goes through the valley of the shadows. But in the midst of his suffering, Job's friends, how do they comfort and console him? Well, listen to this. Eliphaz. "Now, Job, think of who that was innocent ever perished. Are you perishing? Now let's figure out what you've done wrong to deserve this." What about Bildad? "Job, are you suggesting that God is unjust? If you were pure and upright, God would answer you with prosperity." How about Zophar? "How dare you question God's ways? God is all-wise and all-knowing. God knows what's best for you. You're just a guilty sinner. Get well soon, Job. Love, Zophar." There is an old saying, with friends like these, who needs enemies? You see, Job's friends have a very keen sense of God's justice. Because God is the Creator, because God is all-powerful and in control, it follows that the world ought to work in a certain way, like the rhythm of the seasons. Farmers plant their crops in spring and harvest them in the fall, or the birds fly south in the fall and return north in spring. Creation is ordered. God's moral order ought to work the same way. But in case we're getting too hard on Job's friends. Let's pause for a moment to listen to what people say to those who are suffering today. Listen to this. It's God's will. You have to accept it. God never puts on more on us than we can bear. She's gone to a better place. Have you ever heard these words spoken to people who are suffering? AIDS, it's their own fault. Lost your job? You should have worked harder. A man born blind? Someone must have sinned. There must be some neat connection, some direct correlation between bad people and misfortune. We mean well, but what we sometimes say is often so inadequate, like a couple of sandbags against a raging flood. Many years ago, my son was born 3 months prematurely and then spent the next three and a half months in the hospital, most of that in neonatal intensive care. It was an medical emergency at the time, and for many days following, I didn't know if I was going to lose a son and also a spouse. And people didn't know what to say or do. Like Job's friends who came to support him and sat with him for many, many days. I remember quite vividly someone who tried to comfort me with Paul's words from Romans. We know that all things work together for good for those who love God. This person was being very sincere, trying to give me hope, but at the time I couldn't hear it. Rather, it felt as if this person couldn't really confront the darkness and the chaos with me. They thought they were quoting the Bible to give me hope, but ironically it had the opposite effect. And it's not that the words in Romans aren't true. I believe they are. But there is a time to quote scripture, and then there's a time to be quiet. To be quiet and present. Upon being told that it's God's will by a friend on the death of her son, she said, "If this is God's will, then I want absolutely nothing to do with this God." Or as Job said, "Why is light given to one in misery?" In the face of chaos, such inadequate words by friends, it's no wonder that some are driven to even more despair. So, realizing the inadequacy of our theology of chaos, many have learned to say, well, we'll be thinking of you. Job says this world is not in order. This world is not fair. Things don't work out. Creation is not ordered. It's chaotic. Why is light given to one in misery? It's not fair that a couple years ago, a friend of mine in her 20s collapsed in class and found out she had a brain tumor. It's not fair that little children are taken from their homes by their parents because of a civil war, only to die in the Mediterranean Sea. It's not fair. And I'm sure we've all asked ourselves the question, why do bad things happen to good people? When the corrupt, the unjust, and the arrogant seem to live long and full lives. It doesn't make sense. Job, the man on the ash heap, was at first resigned to his fate. "Let the day perish wherein I was born." But then he moves from resignation to anger. Job says to his friends, "You are all miserable comforters. Have windy words no limit? But what provokes you that you keep on talking? God has broken me. God has taken me by the neck and dashed me into pieces. Will God hear my cry? Oh, that God would hear me, that the Almighty would answer me. Job is angry. Does that offend you? Here, Job, a fellow sufferer, fellow questioner, he's rising off the ash heap, his fist clenched and grinding his teeth, ranting and raving at God, demanding from God, why? And Job's friends, Bildad, Eliphaz, Zophar, and Elihu, are so very helpful. And they take up almost 35 chapters of the book to show how helpful they are. But they respond to Job with the same old trite Sunday school cliches. God is all powerful. God makes the rules. We're made to keep the rules. Keep the rules, you'll be blessed. Break the rules, you'll be punished. Nice and neat. No loose ends. It'll all work out for the best. Who that was innocent ever perished? But Job can't square his experience of suffering with this nice, neat moral order that his friends are painting. And he demands an answer. The thing I noticed when I read Job was the use of legal language. And this should get our lawyers in our midst excited. But I would speak to the Almighty, and I desire to argue my case with God. Job is angry and wants to get God into court. But he can't get God into court, because he says, "For God is not a mortal as I am, that I might answer him, that we should come to trial together." And it's not just that he's angry, but he's going further than that. In his anger, Job even accuses God of being a criminal. Listen to this. "For he crushes me with a tempest and multiplies my wounds without cause." Emphasis mine. Job says, "I am blameless. When disaster brings sudden death, God mocks at the calamity of the innocent. The earth is given into the hands of the wicked. He covers the eyes of the judges." That's really powerful stuff. He asks lots of tough questions. If God is the creator, then why do the innocent suffer? If God isn't responsible for suffering and injustice in the world, then who is? Whose world is it anyway? Perhaps there are powers out there that are stronger than God? You see, Job is not impressed with God's creation. Yes, God holds back the waters, but then there's a drought. Yes, God opens the bottle, and then there's a flood. Job sounds like a farmer. Yes, God is powerful, but it's indiscriminate, arbitrary power. God's power is not equated with justice. And so Job sat there on his ash heap and ranted and raved a long time. He prayed, but received no answer. Just silence. But then, to Job's surprise, 38 chapters later, God arrives. Then the Lord answered Job out of the whirlwind, "Gird up your loins." This phrase, gird up your loins, carries the meaning of preparing for an impending war or preparing for hard work. Job, it seems, has some hard work to do. He has to work through his grief and work at gaining a new understanding of who God is. Job apparently also had a keen sense of God's justice. So that drama in the courtroom, God takes the role of the defendant that very quickly takes on the role of the crown attorney. Where were you when I laid the foundations of the earth? Have you commanded the morning since that your days began? Have you comprehended the expanse of the earth? If your image of God has always been one of gentle and soft-spokenness, well, think again. God takes on the role of a crown attorney as one takes on the role of tackling a hostile witness. And the book of Job reminds me of the TV show Law and Order. And God answers Job with lots of questions like, where were you? Who are you? What can you do? In other words, all the questions God fires at Job are a clear signal for Job to finally be quiet. And Job does just that. He says, see, I am of small account. What else can I say? I put my hand over my mouth. I spoke once. I won't speak twice. What else was Job supposed to say after God's cross-examination? Where were you when I laid the foundations of the earth? Can you fashion and place Pleiades, or what's also known as Seven Sister Star Cluster, and their Orion constellation in the heavens? Where were you when I created an ostrich? What is silence and resignation before God the end of the story? Well, no, it's not. God speaks again. Will you turn over my justice? Will you make me out to be evil in order to sustain your innocence? These are important questions. And God continues, behold now, behemoth, which I made even as I made you. Behemoth? In some Bibles, there's a footnote at the bottom that says behemoth is the Hebrew word for hippopotamus, but the word is, or the meaning of the word is uncertain. Can you draw Leviathan with a fishhook? Can you put a hook into Leviathan's nose? Will Leviathan speak soft words to you? Leviathan? Again, some Bibles have a footnote saying the meaning of the word Leviathan is crocodile. But again, that meaning is uncertain. But behemoth and Leviathan, these are two supernatural mythological creatures of the Canaanite religion. And the Canaanites, as you know, were Israelites' neighbors. And the Canaanite religion consisted of a number of powerful supernatural forces of chaos like Behemoth and Leviathan, which wreaked havoc and destruction upon the earth. But do you see what's happened here? God has moved Job from the natural world of stars and constellation and ostriches into the supernatural world of Behemoth and Leviathan. And it's interesting, God does not reprimand Job for getting mad. But by bringing Behemoth and Leviathan into the picture, God reveals a little bit of what it's like to be God in the world. It's not God and the world envisioned by Job or Job's friends, a flat world of simple black and white answers, easy moral formulas, rules and rewards. God shows Job a deeper, darker, confusing creation beyond which Behemoth and Leviathan live. And can you imagine Behemoth? I made him just like I made you. Can you pull Leviathan out with a fish hook? In other words, I think what the book is saying is, Job, if you think you can deal with this dark, chaotic world, then go ahead. Be my guest. You may find out what being God is all about. You'll find out that justice is a good deal more complicated than you think. But Behemoth and Leviathan give us a hint of the disorder and dark chaos for which God must wrestle. Can you pull out mighty Leviathan with a fishhook? Yes, God has created all things. Yes, God is in control of Behemoth and Leviathan, evil and chaos. They're strong, but God restrains them. And they break away every now and again and wreak havoc upon the world, upon our lives. And God's battle with chaos is a lot like war. But we know who will win the war. In fact, the war is over. But, like with most wars, even when it's ended, there's some mopping up to do. Some pockets of resistance that need to be brought under control. It is a vision of a world that's extremely more complex, certainly not simple and easy. It's a big and complex world that God must deal with all the time. And Job has cried out in his chaos and disorder in his own life, but how much greater the chaos against which God strives. And if you came here this morning expecting me to give a nice, neat theological answer to the issue of chaos, I'm sorry. What I said may not be a great answer. I'm not sure if I think it's a great answer. It certainly wasn't an answer Job wanted to hear, but it's a picture of reality in which God struggles. Human suffering is only part of the chaos, one little piece of chaos against which God is in battle. In some ways, Job's understanding of God was the same as his friends. Job's friends had a very simple, black and white understanding of God. God is the creator of the world. Follow God's rules and you are blessed. Break the rules and you are punished. Job, in many ways, had a similar understanding of God. Before encountering God in that whirlwind, Job believed in a God who sat around and meted out justice in a stable, orderly world. God rewards the good, punishes the evil. That was, of course, before he lost his home, his family, and his health. And it was only after his suffering, his ranting and raving against God, did he encounter God and gain a new understanding of who God is. And what was that new understanding? God doesn't answer Job. God doesn't explain away the question, why the innocent suffer. That's because there isn't one. There is no answer to the question why. Rather, the answer, why do the innocent suffer, lies somewhere in all of our questions, our struggling to make sense of it all. For those who are willing to question and question, for those who are willing to work, to really work at their grief, for those who are prepared to get mad, to rant and rave against God, to ask those questions against the dark silence, these people just may well encounter God and be transformed by the encounter. We say prayer changes things, but what does prayer change? We are sometimes arrogant to think that if we ask long enough and hard enough, that God is going to grant our wishes, our demands, our desires. Psalm 23 says, "Even though I walk through the darkest valley." It's interesting that it doesn't use the word avoid, fly over, but walk through the darkest valley. Perhaps it may not be the situation we find ourselves in that will change, but rather will be changed because of the questioning, the struggling as we go through that darkest valley. It's not that God will necessarily change the situation we're in, but that our understanding of God will change. Job came to have a new understanding of God, and it was a complicated, much more complicated world of a God who is busy struggling with chaos, struggling against suffering, against the darkness. And I would venture to say that's also a picture of God that one sees in the New Testament. It's certainly not a God of being removed from the cares and concerns of the world. Not a picture of God sitting up in an ivory tower somewhere. But rather, the New Testament paints a picture of God who comes down to us. God lives and dies on the cross beside two thieves. There, at that time between the cross and that first Easter morning, made war on chaos, Behemoth and Leviathan, and defeated them once and for all. And that resurrection is a sign of that new creation, God with us. And this is where our hope lies. Amen.